Could vaccine hesitancy derail Africa's battle against COVID-19? Hundreds of millions of jabs are arriving at last, but many Africans are reluctant to get one. So what's needed to turn things around? This is Inside Story. Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Deri Nabugeda. Developing nations in Africa have waited months for COVID-19 vaccines as richer countries hoarded supplies. While that remains a problem, the shots are arriving. The World Health Organization says 430 million doses have been delivered continent-wide so far. But only 7% of Africa's 1.3 billion population is fully inoculated, far behind the rest of the world. The WHO wants 70%, but that's not expected to happen for another 3 years. Hesitancy to get jabbed is another problem. South Africa has delayed shipments from both Pfizer and Johnson & Johnson because of concerns its stockpile may expire before being used. Our correspondent Nicholas Hack found similar issues in Senegal.
A precious and life-saving vaccine, free of cost. And yet no one at this COVID-19 vaccination center in downtown Dakar wants to take it. Some passerbys ask Nurse Binta Diallo if the vaccine will make them sterile. Others wonder if it will give them a heart attack or if they'll go blind. Despite her assurances the vaccine is safe and could protect their lives, people don't trust her.
So much misinformation, so much nonsense. Talking about COVID vaccines is like talking about politics. It has become an issue that divides people. Let's make this clear. We need to get vaccinated to protect ourselves and our loved ones. It's the only way.
Among those refusing to get vaccinated is TV pundit and emergency doctor Babacar Nyang. While he treats patients infected with COVID-19, Nyang is famous for his postings on social media. He argues that as long as Western pharmaceutical companies refuse to waive patents so that vaccines can be produced locally, they should not be trusted or used on Africans.
It's not a vaccine, it's a product being tested on people. That's why people are getting sick despite the vaccine.
Too much fear, misinformation, and not enough vaccines means that only 10% of Africans have been vaccinated. Nigeria, home to 200 million people, is only inoculated an average of 1,000 people a day. In Senegal, more than 200,000 expired doses have been destroyed.
This is where the COVID vaccine is being stored. It needs to be kept between 2 and 8 degrees Celsius. The challenge is to get those vaccines in remote health centers where the ambient temperatures is around 40 to 30 degrees Celsius. Also, it's a race against time for health workers to get as many people inoculated before these doses expire.
For Nurse Diallo, the new variant is spreading faster than we think, partly because of widespread misinformation. This vaccine hesitancy has a cost, perhaps barely visible for now, but she fears a wave of infections lies ahead. Nicholas Hawk, Al Jazeera, Dakar.
Well, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is being manufactured in South Africa. Government leaders there have pledged to donate around 2 million doses to other African nations. Famida Miller has more from Johannesburg.
South Africa is set to manufacture just over 2 million doses of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. The vaccines will be distributed to other African countries over the next year through the African Union. Now, so far, just 7% of Africans have been fully vaccinated, and this distribution is expected to benefit the lowest income countries as quickly as possible. Now, that's despite the US CDC flagging concerns around some side effects and proposing that other vaccines be used rather than J&J. But South African experts say they've not seen any alarming signals in local studies, and that while they are aware of side effects, they're rare, and the benefits of the J&J vaccine outweigh the risks. South Africa's BioVac Institute will also start making the Pfizer vaccine early next year, and South Africa's role will be to finish and fill the vaccine manufacture process once that vaccine is received from Europe. The World Health Organization and others are working on establishing Africa's first COVID vaccine technology hub. Now, that's as vaccine companies have been criticized for not doing enough to help African and developing countries. While South Africa will now play a greater role in the manufacture of vaccines, it, along with countries like India, continue to push for vaccine patent waivers to allow for the manufacture of vaccines in more countries. There are companies in South Africa trying to develop their own vaccines, but as long as pharmaceutical companies refuse to share information on vaccines, the rollout of African manufactured vaccines will take far longer. Famida Miller for Inside Story, Johannesburg.
Let's now bring in our guest. Joining us from Johannesburg is Helen Rees, who's the chair of the Regional Immunization Technical Advisory for Africa for the World Health Organization. From Nairobi, Anand Madhvani, co-founder of COVID Kenya. That's an association which uses social media to create awareness of COVID-19 issues. Also from Johannesburg, Karsten Noko, a lawyer with an interest in human rights and global health issues. Thank you so much for speaking to us on Inside Story. Helen Rees, if I may start with you. As we've been reporting, millions of vaccines have now been dispersed across the African continent, yet vaccination rates stand at around 7.3%, with many countries, in fact, hovering around 1%. That's according to data from the Africa Centers for Disease Control. To what extent is vaccine hesitancy contributing to that low vaccination rate?
Well, I think let me start with saying that one of the reasons for the low vaccination rate was the delays in getting vaccines to many countries. And if we go back even further, that was a delay in global funding and a delay in the companies themselves, in some instances, actually sharing vaccines with things like the COVAX facility or the African Union initiative. So that's the primary reason that pushed this delay. But now, you're right, we are seeing some hesitancy. But the hesitancy here has kind of got a couple of combination reasons. The first is that in many settings, it's not easy to access the vaccination services. We're talking about low-resource countries where health systems were already under a lot of strain. And that means that people will have to go in queue, they'll have to wait in clinics, they'll have to travel long distances to get to try and get a vaccine. And all of those things are disincentives. Remember that many people are informal workers. So if it takes a day to travel to queue to get a vaccine, that can mean that you don't want to do it because that's a day's income gone. So there are very real social drivers of hesitancy that we sometimes forget. But the other reason, the same that we've seen throughout the world, is disinformation, misinformation, and then genuine reasons of hesitancy, such as, are the vaccines safe? Were they developed too quickly? Are they okay to give to my teenage children or to young adults? Many questions that are legitimate questions that we need to answer.
Okay, all important points, and we're going to drill down into them a little later. But Karsten Noko, what's your point of view on this? And would you say that vaccine hesitancy is a problem from what you've seen and the research that you've done?
Indeed, I think vaccine hesitancy is an issue. And thanks to the colleague for also explaining some of the issues that contribute to vaccine hesitancy. One of the issues as well, I think that she touches on that I want to speak about, is the issue of trust. So there is a long history of mistrust between the communities who receive vaccines and medical services, and the people who are behind the scientific research that is done in many parts of the world. So everything from the kind of clinical trials that are done where people are subjected to clinical trials without their consent. So all of these things don't help, especially when we have a pandemic like this. They just make things much worse. But yeah, I would definitely agree that for me, trust is a very key issue that communities have between themselves and the suppliers and manufacturers of vaccines.
Okay, thank you so much. Anand Madhvani from Nairobi, can you give us an overview of the situation in Kenya?
Yes, it's similar in some ways to South Africa, but we have poorer infrastructure in some ways. Hesitancy is also to do with, it's quite mild, but the issues about access and the delays in starting the vaccination program have been the same. In some ways, we have less less of the kind of conspiracy theory stuff happening in Kenya. You know, in South Africa, you have a lovely constitution and people know their rights. Here, our government is different. So the government has been threatening people, but people aren't saying, you know, I need to look after my personal freedoms, because we don't really have a sense of that so strongly here. It's more people need reassurance. They need simple explanations and they need the vaccines to be easily available. We've had them landing at the airport, but getting them out to remote counties and sparse populations is much, much harder.
Helen Rees, you spoke about some of the logistical problems that are facing some countries over in Africa. Can you give us a sort of an overview or some context as to where we actually are with the vaccine rollout? And are there some countries better equipped or supplied to look after their populations more so than others, perhaps?
Yes, well, as you would imagine, the countries, that the richer countries in the region, such as South Africa, have got better infrastructure. And so it's been easier, although not easy, but easier to really scale up a national program. But as was said, you know, many countries are small. We have fragile states. We have areas that are conflict zones. And many have sparse populations, migrant populations, nomadic populations, which are difficult to access. If you think about South Sudan, for example, at the moment, there are areas in South Sudan that have severe flooding. But anyway, in the rainy season, the road access is extremely difficult. So for each country, there'll be a specific diagnostic of how easy it is programmatically to get vaccines out. But having said that, we do have the experience of getting vaccines out for the childhood immunization programs in every country across the region. In many countries, we've had high rates of childhood immunization for many years. Although we'll see in big countries like Nigeria that you might have high rates, for example, around Lagos, but lower rates once you get into other areas. So we do have a backbone and learnings from that. And we do now have tools that have been developed by the World Health Organization and the World Bank that have looked at country readiness programmatically to receive the vaccines, to store the vaccines, to roll out the vaccines, and to communicate on the vaccines. And countries are doing these self-assessments before receiving the vaccines to assist them in trying to remedy the areas which are weakest in terms of vaccine rollout.
Helen, even though the World Health Organization has been warning for many months now that targets to vaccinate the continent would in fact not be reached. So would you agree that what you see on the ground really confirms that it's an uphill struggle going forward?
Well, it has been an uphill struggle. And as I say, that was also because of access to vaccines and because high-income countries in the early part of the pandemic purchased many of the vaccines that were available, making them not available to groups. As I say, the African Union has an initiative and COVAX is a global initiative wanting to purchase vaccines for low middle income countries and for the African region. So that has been, you know, one of the problems. Now, we are seeing that the flow of vaccines in the last quarter of this year and certainly in the first quarter of next year is beginning to really increase. That's really good news. We've also seen the high income countries now offering donations of vaccines, which is great and to be really encouraged. One of the problems, however, has been that some of those donations have had vaccines with short shelf lives. Now, you can imagine if you are in a setting where programmatically it's difficult to roll out, to get vaccines out into the periphery, to maintain cold chains, to mobilize clinics and communities, then if you've got a short shelf life, that has been quite a struggle. And that's certainly something that's been discussed between recipient countries and donor countries as well. But to be encouraged, but we need to think about the logistics of what sort of vaccines are going to be suitable for a donation.
Karsten Noko, you've said in an opinion piece that leaders over in Africa need to make healthcare a priority. What has the pandemic taught us about the state of healthcare in countries on the African continent?
So, indeed, the state of healthcare leaves a lot to be desired. There are many structural issues that go back many decades that have not been resolved. And I think when we have the pandemic, what it just does is that it exacerbates a situation that is already quite bad. So Everything from the fact that, you know, as I said in the opinion piece, there's not enough resources made available for healthcare, and some of the structural policy, structural decisions that are made when states shy away from budgeting sufficient money. So if I speak about the African continent, for example, there is the Abuja Declaration where states committed to set aside 15% of their budgets for healthcare, and this has not been happening. In actual fact, what has been happening is that the funds or the resources available for access to healthcare have been reducing over years. So yes, the structural issues, the logistical challenges, the infrastructural challenges, but also one of the things that we have to speak about is the impact of conflict on the African continent. Many countries have parts, geographical, large geographical parts that are not accessible because of conflict. And for these communities, whatever rollout is made, it means for them, it's another hurdle that healthcare workers
have to cross. Which is something that Helen was mentioning a moment ago. But Karsten, let me ask you this. You also say that class, to an extent, class and race also help explain the mismatch between vaccine intention and action. Can you elaborate on that point? How so?
Yes, so for me, the issue is that we see the impact of politics, so class and race playing a role. We see how Western nations are able to hoard vaccines in collusion with vaccine manufacturers. We see that even when vaccines are available at a price that is more in African continents. So African countries have to pay more for vaccines, and yet the vaccines are still not available. And the people who are prepared to pay less have the vaccines in greater abundance. So we see all of this. We see the role of, you know, the people who are excluded from healthcare. So the notion that if we vaccinate one part of the world and in the global north, that these people who live in that part of the world will be protected from vaccine from the pandemic, sorry. And now we start to see with the new variant Omicron, cases are surging forward, and people now start to realize that in actual fact, the message that has been passed by a lot of activists that no one is safe until everyone is safe is actually true. And now people are trying to play catch up.
Right.
But a lot has been lost already.
Anand Madbani, to what extent, this was touched upon a little bit, I'd like to go into more detail on this particular issue, and that is the economic reasons. To what extent do economic reasons play a role here? Some people are reluctant to give up a day's work to travel in order to go and take a vaccine, aren't they?
Yes, and especially when there's uncertainty that you would actually get the vaccine at the end of the day. Like at the moment, we're not very well organized in Kenya. As has been mentioned before, we have a backbone of vaccine rollouts, but that's usually childhood vaccinations. So the expectation is that young mothers probably would bring in a child on a weekday, and that's a normal low-level thing. But now we're looking at a mass adult vaccination, and we really need vaccination centers open on weekends and in other easier to reach places, so that even in the cities, people are saying, you know, I could spend half a day going somewhere and I don't know if I'll get the vaccine. And I can't, even myself, I've been working on this for some time, but I don't know where to direct people because that information is constantly changing and it's not easily available. Now, that's multiplied if you're in a rural area and you need to travel. But another element of this is that if you have healthcare and you know that you're okay if you get side effects, then obviously you're going to be more comfortable going to get a vaccine. One of the rumors that's going around is that you'll have side effects, you may not be able to work, and that is affecting poorer people who don't trust the healthcare system necessarily. So they're not feeling comfortable to go.
And isn't that a case, Anand, of this distrust? I mean, it predates COVID and vaccinations, doesn't it?
It's not so. So it's a little bit different here in Kenya. And generally, there is, I think trust is very, very important, but it's also because people are very frayed from the pandemic. people are already scared and frightened. Economics comes into that. You know, our economy has been hit really hard. We haven't actually seen that many cases in Kenya in the same way. So we're not as frightened of the of COVID itself. And that's a problem. Like, people aren't as worried about it, so they're not taking the measures. But at the same time, people are just exhausted. So adding an extra thing which creates a source of uncertainty is really difficult. And there isn't much trust in the government to say, you know, the government are telling me to go and get vaccinated, let me go. There's actually distrust. So if the government says something, people are suspicious.
Right. Helen, Moderna has said that it was working on plans to bottle doses of its COVID vaccine somewhere on the African continent, and that could take place as soon as 2023. So is that going to make a difference, you think, for those people who remain vaccine hesitant and who don't trust the Western pharmaceutical companies?
If you mentioned Moderna, Moderna, of course, would be regarded as a Western vaccine. But also 2023 is a long way off. And we've got 2022, in which we need to get nearly as many of the world's population to have a basic primary series of a vaccine. And this should be just about any vaccine that's available, but a complete series. And the reason we're saying just take the vaccines that are there and available is that nearly all the vaccines have a positive impact on reducing severe disease and hospitalization. And at the moment, that's still what we're focusing on. We're focusing, and particularly in our region, on not overwhelming our health services. The health services are already overstretched and often have limited resources. So if you get a huge wave and unvaccinated people, it will be the unvaccinated that will be admitted to hospital, and that will quickly overwhelm a limited resource setting. So in terms of Moderna, Moderna is a good vaccine. There are many good vaccines out there, but 2023 is a bit too far away. And I think most of us would have preferred to see vaccines like the Moderna vaccine in the continent at an earlier stage.
Anand, would you like to weigh in? I saw you nodding along.
Yes, I mean, we have some people worrying about which vaccine they're going to get and trying to shop around. And we're also just encouraging people to get whatever they can get easily. But I don't think that's really a huge concern. The general concern where there is some worry is about side effects. And we can reassure people they just need a conversation and to see other people who've been vaccinated. But I agree, like 2023, we need something. We need things much faster than that.
Karsten, and final word to you. I saw you nodding along as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it is high time we accept that we do not have the luxury of time. I think the multiple waves of COVID continue to show this to us. It is about time that governments really step up and take on their responsibility of providing healthcare. We have to accept that, you know, the free market policies that are so infused into public health, where we have to depend on companies to provide vaccines, is not working for the majority of people to improve access to vaccines, and that it is
right.
Time
but these
that
calls
we,
that you we... make to just forgive me there, but these calls to scale up the public health system. I mean, is that possible given the amount of stress the systems are under right now?
So if we don't do that, then we collapse what little healthcare systems we have. So we don't have the luxury of time. I don't think that we can sit back and say, because you are in the middle of the pandemic, we cannot be doing this. In actual fact, I think that this moment of public health crisis should be a wake-up call, and we should be looking at solutions today. We cannot be waiting until 2023 to get people vaccinated. No one knows what a new mutation of the virus will be like in 2022, it could really overwhelm the public health systems once again.
Okay, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you, Helen Rees, Anand Madhavani, and Karsten Noko. We appreciate your time. Thank you for watching. You can see the program again anytime by visiting our website, aljazeera.com. For further discussion, you can go to our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/AJInsideStory. You can join the conversation on Twitter. Our handle is AJInsideStory from myself and the whole team right here in Doha. Thanks for watching, and bye-bye for now.